Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Carlo Hinterman, the co-author, along with Daniele Villa, of Terrence Malick, Rehearsing the Unexpected. It is a great oral history about all the filmmakers and collaborators surrounding Terrence Malick and helping to create some of the most significant films of the 20th and 21st century. That's a fascinating read, and I recommend it to everybody. We'll be talking about that, as well as the career of the filmmaker. Carlo is also himself a filmmaker, having made The Book of Vision and a documentary about Terrence Malick called Rosy Finger Dawn. If you like the episode, please remember to spread the word. But before you do any of that, just enjoy the conversation.
I think when I was studying history of cinema, and I watched Badlands, and I was blown away by many aspects of the movie. And since then, I watched the other movies of Terrence Malick. And what it was very interesting for me, it was to place his cinema inside the history of American cinema, because I was very fascinated with the many relationship with other movies, like classical wise, for example, like The Giant, and so I tried to understand a little bit more. But as you know, it was very difficult to find something and to read something and to study his work somehow.
When was this? When was the time that you?
It was in the 1990. 2, 3, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so then I went to study cinema in the United States, and then I came back to Italy and I started working for a publishing house. Ubu Libri is the name. It was the major publishing house focused on theater and cinema, with a strict relation with Faber and Faber. And so I started editing books on cinema, and I wanted to do something on Terrence Malick together with my friends who were working with me. And so when we decided to do our first documentary with our production company, we decided to do a documentary on Terry cinema. And so I remember we wrote to the agent of Malik that immediately say, no way, it's impossible. You know that it's really impossible to do something. Even if it's not on screen, it's very difficult to have his approval to do the project. And so I simply say, okay, give me the chance to write a letter to him. And in this letter, I try to explain exactly these things that I wanted to collect different interviews, trying to put the cinema of Malik in perspective inside the American cinema. And in a way, he liked the approach probably. And so we had the first meeting and we decided how to structure the documentary. We explained our ideas and he agreed on that. And we started putting together all the protagonists of the movie, which was very fascinating. It was a really a kind of journey to discuss and start an exchange with them. And so that's how it started, actually. And of course, then I was really, when I did the Thin Red Line, I was completely enthusiastic about the movie. And I remember I was in contact with Enrico Ghezzi, which is an Italian film critic who was in Berlin. And at the festival when the movie won the Golden Bear there. And so it was so enthusiastic about the movie, and he was writing the preface of a book on Josseliani that we were writing, and I was so curious, so I went immediately to watch the movie, and you know, again I started wondering to work and with him and to meet him and to start to have an exchange with him, that at the end we succeeded to do, and it was very fantastic.
So Enrico Ghezzi, for our listeners, is an Italian sort of cultural film critic, and he's also, isn't he the creator of Blob, the writer?
Yeah, Blob and Fuori Orario, yes.
Which is sort of like very cultish. I don't know how you would call them. Sort of, they're almost like Godardian film essays, but based on what's happening in the world at the moment, and splices together lots of brilliant sort of. They're really good. I remember when I first arrived in Italy, Blob was one of the one things that I could watch because I didn't really understand the language very well, but I totally understood what was going on.
Yeah, very 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 smart and very sharp.
And Fuori Orario, which was like a late night sort of film series where they would put stuff that you basically didn't get an opportunity to see elsewhere. I mean, in the UK, sort of an equivalent would maybe be Moviedrome, or in America something like I don't know what there would be in America actually. But okay, so when you were making the documentary, you met Terry Malik as a result of that beforehand, and how did that come about, and what was that situation like?
Yeah, basically the first time we met him through Enrico Ghezzi in Milanesiana, which is a festival in Milan, and it was presenting the restoration of Badlands. And we had a great discussion because we start explaining the idea of the documentary, and we ended in discussing about cinema and about the world. It was a very warm conversation, and it was very, very interesting because it was in a way attracted by these three young crazy guys who did whatever to meet him. And and then we had an exchange about our idea, and plus all the time that we had the idea of involving someone like actors, director of photography, whatever, we had an exchange with him to understand, and for him it was very nice because in a way we help him to reconnect with some people of the past. And so in a way it was really interesting to trace this network of people. And actually the movie was about that, because it was our journey through United States, going to different places to catch these different people and to share basically an idea of cinema, of making cinema in a different way, in a way that, you know, the movie is something that is growing and is really, it creates relationship and something that is a breathing entity in a way. It's alive and it is really something that it was a big lesson for us and also for the movie that we did after. And so it was really a fantastic start for us, because it was the first documentary and also the first movie that we produced with our production company.
The name of the documentary, this was the Rosy Fingered Dawn?
Exactly.
Yeah. And who were your collaborators on that?
Excuse me?
Who were your collaborators on the film?
Yes, we basically we directed the movie, the three of us, and we produced with our company and an Italian company, at the end we put together all the main collaborators of Terry. It was right after the Thin Red Line, and so we interviewed Arthur Penn, Jean Caviezel, Sean Penn, Martin Sheen, Irving Keschner, and because we wanted also to interview the people that helped Terry at the beginning of his career. So Arthur Penn has a very big role. And it was a very moving meeting, because again, it was an occasion of talking about cinema in general, and also to talk about the season of the great American cinema that was really fantastic to discover all the different collaboration between people, and then of course the Jack Fisk who did a lot of movies as a production designer with Terry, but he has a really strong relationship with him. And also the George Stevens Jr. that you it wasn't your podcast actually, I think, no?
And yes,
I heard it was a fantastic interview, because he's a brilliant guy and he's, you know, behind many of the things that happen in New American cinema and behind David Lynch and also the relationship between David Lynch, Terrence Malick, and Jack Fisk. And so this is the aim of the documentary, was exactly to show this relationship and create this connection between people. Billy Weber, that is the editor of the first movie of Malick, a brilliant editor actually, and so it was really, really interesting.
I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about the book as well, in terms of you write very much a sort of oral history of the filmmaking, and you say very explicitly right at the beginning, this book is not meant to be a biography of Terrence Malick. From the very first moment when we started working on this project, we understood that Malick's decision not to speak about his filmmaking is deeply rooted in his conviction that the films should speak for themselves. And so, you know, you respect that sort of thing. That oral history sort of also has the sort of side effect that it kind of sounds a little bit like The Thin Red Line. You have this chorus of you know, this chorus of voices that build up this picture of a creative project. As you say, it's not necessarily just one man's vision, it's a group of people who are moving filmmaking forward.
Actually, I think that The Thin Red Line was a source of inspiration, really. It's because finally the voiceover became this kind of oral way of you know, analyze the same things and have little change and had something. And it was really inspiring both for the documentary and the book, actually, because we wanted to show how it's important in cinema to create a common language, actually, that you share with your collaborators. We strongly believe in that, and it's what happened during the Nouvelle Vague in France, that actually you are sharing something, and while you are making a movie, you also redefining the way of making movie. And so we really wanted to show that through the book, which was a very long journey, because actually we started right after the documentary, we finished years later, actually. and because we wanted to have someone, and we felt that it was the case to do another interview. And but really it was the aim was this one of creating this oral in a way. It was to pay homage to the cinema terrible, but to pay homage to cinema in general.
I found it an absolute fascinating read, and I've obviously gone back to it many, many times, and you know, it's also kind of this odd creature in the Faber and Faber family, because most, when you would get a book like this, most of the time it would be Scorsese on Scorsese, or Terry Gilliam on Terry Gilliam, or Jane Campion on Jane Campion. And this really should be Malick on Malick, but of course that's impossible. So this is the way around that. Yeah.
Yeah, this is how we pitch the book to Faber, in the sense that what we say is to take advantage of this limitation, actually, to not consider the fact that Terry was not talking about the cinema in first person, but to take advantage of that and see how much the spirit of Malick is inside the world of other people, and is inside his work, actually. And so they found these things fascinating, and that's how we work. Then what we really think, that many of the people that we interview are really central for the world of cinema nowadays. I think that Malick is one of the big creators of language, and if you see the consequence of what is putting in his movie on the screen, you can find in commercial, in many, it's like really the language of Malick is everywhere in a way. And when you interview a DP that work with him, or a production designer, you understand that behind this power there is this collaboration, and so really is a way of showing how important is the relationship between professionals, and professionals that work with many different directors, which is very, very interesting. If I think of for example, Jörg Widmer, who is the director of photography of the last two Malick's movie, but he was the Steadicam operator and cameraman, which he Volubeski for the other movie of Terry. And he had the relationship, with many directors all around the world, and his way of framing is really vibrant in a way. It's something incredible, and you can see the difference of his framing in Bieladar movie, in Terrence Malick, in Woody Allen, in some sequence in Tarantino. So it's very interesting to see the power of the cinema language, and so the interview were an occasion to point out this element, which for me is very, very, very important.
I mean, is there a sort of something problematic there? I want to sort of like introduce maybe a little bit of a devil's advocacy here, that I totally agree with you. I think Terry Malick's language has seeped into beer adverts, let's say, and he himself has made adverts, you know, recently. And isn't there a sort of like, there's that danger that no matter how new the language is, it will be sort of co-opted and used, and then it's sort of like you have to do it again, because otherwise the next thing that looks like a Terrence Malick movie also looks like a beer advert.
Yeah, you know, it's complicated things, and I think that it's very fascinating the way Terry is continuously reinventing something and reinvigorating something in a way, and I'm thinking, for example, of the use of the lenses, which is very interesting, and then when you come to use this very wide lens. Sometimes it's something that is related also with the experiment with the company that are producing those equipment. And so there is always the idea of pushing the boundaries and do something completely new. And for example, I was really surprised when I started doing commercial or other things with a little GoPro camera and sometimes with an eye with the phone but this is inside the Terry spirit that is always looking for something, a new tool, a new way, because it's also very the interesting things if you talk with the director of photography that work with him. Is the knowledge he has of the camera equipment, film stock at the time that he was working with film stock, and he's always is a director who is writing the movie with the camera in a way, and I think that he's close to Bernardo Bertolucci for certain things in a way that the movement of the camera. Is the way you are telling a story actually is never something that you apply to a story and you use, but is part of the way you are telling something and you are showing something and this is I think it's really something that avoid all the risk of repeating, but give you the chance to let the movie burst in a way and arrive to the audience in a very free way, and I think that this is the power of be very free without thinking of the mediation between the movie and the audience, but let something flow in a way, you know, and I think that this is also tricky because the more a certain director, including Terry, are doing these things, the more they are divorcing from the film critics, actually, because they want to see always the same things, the things that they like in a way or for them is familiar. I remember after the Thin Red Line, they wanted another Thin Red Line. They wanted something that in a way has this pace. If I think instead of Terry, of Takeshi Kitano, of in a way also Cronenberg and other directors, they are always doing their own movie without thinking. And this is something for me that is very brave and I think is the way actually to do cinema. But it's very difficult actually because many people has the prejudice that for Terry everything is very simple in the sense that you stay in a position that is very simple to put a movie together but it's not like that for an artist that is doing something that because the movie is urgent in a way is always very difficult to do that.
Have you seen Lantern Mills, the very first short film that Malick made?
No, actually no. We tried, but because there was Terry asked not to to show the movie. Actually, we tried, but then we didn't see. So we didn't see watch the movie actually.
Oh my, that's like a holy grail of, and I've got a feeling if we got the opportunity to see it, we would just go, yeah, it's okay, you know, it's a student film, it's not gonna.
Yeah, it depends. For example, I remember when I watched another director that I really love is Oder Joseliani, the Georgian director, and I remember that for many years it was impossible to watch the first movie, exactly a student movie that he did for the diploma in the school in Moscow. And at the end, when I finally watched, instead I found that it was really the core of all the cinema that he did after, actually. It's possible that, you know, it's hiding something that is the the seed of the cinema. So, who knows?
That wouldn't, yeah, that's another alternative, isn't it? That's another idea. So he makes, he grows up mainly in Texas. He has this sort of period in when he's in his 20s where he's going from academia to journalism, and he finally gets to the AFI in Los Angeles, makes his student film. And then he makes this, this debut, which, you know, Badlands wasn't exactly didn't like take over the world. It wasn't like one of those debuts like Reservoir Dogs for Tarantino that everybody loved. It was kind of more a Citizen Kane, where it was admired but greeted a little bit ambivalently and then gained its reputation later. Is that accurate, do you think? Or anything there that I'm...
Yes, it was very interesting, the story of Badlands, because actually, even the way it was made, I think that it was very interesting, because it was produced by Edward Pressman, that then became a very important producer. But at the time, it was putting together the money in a very, strange way, in the sense that he used a little bit of the money of the company of the family that was a toy company making toys. And it was really attracted by Terry, but also because of the involvement of Arthur Penn, who in a way, he was a kind of mentor, who say, okay, for me, I think that it's really important to make this movie. And it was very complicated to make, because actually they changed three different DOP, and it lasted for a while, and Terry went shooting by himself several things, and so even the story of the making is very interesting. Right? It was a magical for many. A reason also for Martin Sheen that originally he considered himself too old for the characters by the end Diane Crittenden, who was the casting director, and together with Terry decided to cast him, and he put all himself inside the movie. And then also the story of the release of the movie was interesting, because actually Warner Bros. Took the rights of the movie, which was incredible for all the production team, because actually they were able to finally pay the deferred payment that they did. Nobody believed at the beginning that at the end they will receive that money. Instead, it was possible, but it was strange, because it was premiered at New York Film Festival, and he had good review by the critics. But as you say, it was not a blast, something huge actually. But then the first release was very tricky, because Warner Bros. Decided to marketing the movie as a kind of action movie, road movie, and it didn't work at all, actually. And so they decided together with Pressman to do a second release of the movie that was a little release, but in many different cities around the United States. And in this way, the movie really grew over the times and it became something, a kind of landmark film even in the cinema world. They start really to understand how different the movie was. Then there was the screening in Cannes, and it was the reception there was good, and also there is also the only interview that Terry did actually to Michel Simon that did the interview to him in occasion of the release of Badlands. So in a way, it's a movie that over the years really became a cult in a way. But it took several years to reach this status.
David Thompson, in the sort of biographical dictionary of film, sort of says this is the best debut since Citizen Kane, maybe even better, because the guy just turns up out of nowhere, whereas Orson Welles has already been working in the theatre and the radio, and so he's sort of already got a certain degree of celebrity and freedom, whereas this is a genuinely independent movie. I recently rewatched Days of Heaven, which is the second film that Malick makes in the 70s, about 3 or 4 years later, and that always surprises me how much Malick has already established his style in a way which is just from the... I mean, there's a little bit of a David Lynch thing with that sort of Chicago opening and the industrial noises and the lack of dialogue, but just the elliptical style, the way you can't settle necessarily on a character, the stunning beauty of the images, the way the camera moves, everything is just like that film could have been made yesterday. It's just so it feels so fresh when you rewatch it.
Yeah, actually, I think that it was really this. I think that Malick was always in search of something, and in the cinematic language, and also the way he was choosing the collaborators was very smart. So the idea of having Nestor Almendros as director of photography that were coming from mainly Truffaut cinema. And in the United States, there was a big jump for him. In fact, it was interesting because it was not easy to work with all the American professionals. That was the thing that Terry was looking for, in the sense to have a director of photography that was able really to be in relationship with the landscape, which is a character on its own. And I think that the link with the giant is really, really strong, actually. And the link with Texas that I started understanding the United States, I think, because I studied in New York. So when I started the movie on Terry, I understand that the United States was a completely different thing. So that I knew just a little portion of an entire universe. And the person that really helped me in understanding the United States was Sam Shepard, because he has an incredible view of the power of certain state like Texas, for example, and where something wild is always there, ready to burst and to let something incredible happen, and this tension that you can feel. And there was a very interesting thing, so because talking with Seth Shepard, I understood how much it was linked with Texas, which is something that I understood, but just a little. Through him, I really realized how important was the relationship with the landscape, but also the feeling of being alone in that vast scenario. And it was very interesting because he was saying that at that time, people were so alone that they create, they built a house without nobody there, just with a light inside, to have the feeling to have a company there, which is something incredible, no? And so through this aspect, the exchange that I had with Sam Shepard, I understood how much the movies were very rooted in this idea of United States, this wild aspect. It's like going to Eden in a way, to a land that it's virgin on one side and ready to be corrupt on the other side. And this was something really that I think in the movie is very strong. And another brilliant idea was the one of involving Ennio Morricone, because I think that the score is the best score that the Morricone did, in my opinion. In the sense, is very free, and he has this, for example, this feeling that everything is doomed in a way, that those characters are doomed. They are haunted by the place, reverberates in the music a lot, that put the character together, right? Like in a vortex. And again, it was another brilliant idea, no? The take element for another world, for the Western European cinema, and put in something that was so rooted in the America cinema, actually, like the relation with the giant. There are certain images with the house in the distance, in the giant, they are really, really close to the movie.
And of course, a George Stevens connection as well there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
George Stevens, because, the director of Giant.
This is a very good connection, because I think the idea of George Stevens Jr. in AFI, it was to put the student in contact with the master of American cinema. So they had really the chance to have an exchange, which was very, very important, crucial for some of them. And it's also how they found their mentor and people that helped them also to make their first movie, like Arthur Penn did, for example. And so I think that Malick is unique, because he's always on the edge of this different world of cinema, and he has the ability of putting together the best of different world. And Days of Heaven, I think, is a fantastic example of that. Mm. And it's really, really impressive. I'm thinking, for example, even when Askel Vexer came into the movie and he did basically the second part, because Nestor Almendros was committed to a movie of Truffaut, so he needed to go away at a certain point, and Askel Vexler did the work. And it's incredible how the approach of Vexler was able to bring something new tense to the movie, like the hand camera movement, many things that was belonging to a cinema that was really, Askel Vexler, apart from the big movie that received Oscar or whatever, he did a lot of documentaries in the street of Los Angeles with this approach of having the camera on the shoulder, and he was able to bring also this energy, for example, in the scene at the beginning in the factory in Days of Heaven. That is this this element that in this fantastic beauty and something that could be close to a painting, there is something, there is an energy that is ready to burst at certain point. And it happened with the killing and other elements that are very violent in the movie. So it's incredible how Terry take advantage of this different energy on the set. I think that is the best quality of him, is really to put the people in the position to do their best for the movie. And this is a huge lesson for me.
Yeah, it's a funny sort of contradiction, isn't it? Because we have these ideas of these auteurs who are so huge and so, you know, dominant, and there's no doubt about it, there is a Malickian aesthetic, there is a Kubrickian way of looking at things. But, you know, Kubrick is about marshalling all these talents and being a magnet to all these people. And the same is true of Terrence Malick. He brings all these people, including acting talent, you know, into his films. And I mean, acting talent that has previously been unknown. You know, I mean, his first two films, Martin Sheen, Sissy Spacek, I mean, not their first films, but nonetheless their first major roles. Richard Gere in Days of Heaven, Sam Shepard's first ever acting role. He hasn't even considered acting really up until that point. Yeah, and then sort of cuts out most of his performances. Maybe because he hadn't quite got it yet. But yeah, no, I mean, it's that marshalling of collaboration rather than the auteur just doing everything themselves, and you know.
Yeah, this is a fantastic thing in the sense that talking with Sam Shepard was saying you cannot be a spoiled actor with Terry, in the sense that you need always, you can be a baby that the director feed you with a spoon. You need to be your own person, actually, and this is completely true, and I think that the magical things of assist to the shooting of a movie of Terry is see how much is a kind of Rabdoman who is playing with the energy of the actor, putting the actor in a situation, suggesting something in a very little way, throwing a line of dialogue all of a sudden and doing something like that, but at the same time giving a lot of responsibility to the actor, but to the entire crew, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting when he obtains something that he considers good, how rewarding is this attitude, how much you are really happy that you are giving your contribution to the movie. I had the chance of shooting some of the image of the Tree of Life, and I knew exactly that if the images that I was shooting were not at the level of this fantastic, eloquent, incredible, beautiful movie, were never in the movie. So I put all my effort to try, you know, to stay and to try to give a contribution, like if that image was what he was looking for at the moment. And in certain cases, he was giving me, I don't know, part of the Divine Comedy and say, okay, I would like something that is like this part of the Divine Comedy, the moment of Paolo and Francesca, for example, that they love is symbolized by the fly of some birds. And he was told, telling to me, okay, I want something like that. So you go with your camera and you put all yourself to try to catch a moment that is close to what is looking for. And I really, you can really feel that people put all their effort and all the skills to reach this goal. And at the end, it's very rewarding. And so it's... Is really the ability of create an ecosystem in the sense that hollow to rehearsing the unexpected. We brought in the book is really a question of rehearsing the unexpected, in the sense to be ready for catch the unexpected, and which is something that is not so easy. Requires a lot of effort.
It's catching lightning in a bottle half the time.
Yeah.
No. And I mean, you started talking about Tree of Life then, and I was saying, well, let's go chronologically. But then, of course, then he starts kind of filming Tree of Life straight after Days of Heaven, because he starts working on this project, which, I mean, this is one of the things that I think your book is really interesting, because it to some degree dispels a lot of the myths of Terrence Malick as this big, huge, unapproachable, yada, yada, yada. And it's like, no, we worked with him. He changed his mind about this. He had another idea about that. It's, you know, it's a much more human image of a person, which I always think is much more interesting than the legend.
Yeah, actually, is exactly like this, and this was the aim that we had both for the documentary and for the book, because it was so exciting to have an exchange with him that we want to show how much generous and how much into this world he was, in the sense that is a person with a great sense of humor and with a fantastic ability of establishing relationship. And so is exactly as you said. For example, the Tree of Life started with the project that was Q at the time, the title, and he started filming in Sicily the eruption of Etna and other things, and again with the same attitude to go around the world to catch something that was a seed inside the movie, something that probably you will see years later in the movie, because actually, for example, the actual footage shot in the 70s of the Etna, it was used in the Tree of Life. Then it was re-edited and it was transferred to digital, but actually they use also some of the footage. So it's like the movie is there and is something organic that is growing over the years, which is very fascinating.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Absolutely. I mean, that's all these sort of little seeds. That word you use, seeds, is perfect because they're all planted. I mean, The New World, which becomes a film he makes after The Thin Red Line, I think the script was written between Badlands and Days of Heaven.
Yeah, but actually even the work that he did writing for other directors or rewrite some script for these things, Mike Medavoy has a really crucial role, because actually was the manager and the agent of Terry, but he was the manager of Spielberg, Lucas, Michael Cimino, a lot of the new American cinema. And so in each one of these projects, he was putting something of his idea of cinema. There is, for example, a fantastic work that he did together with Irving Keschner, writing the script of Dirty Harry. And then actually because Keschner didn't want to shoot the movie with Eastwood, because he wanted Marlon Brando as protagonist, he decided not to do the movie, and but they spent years in building the project and writing the movie, and in all and also the rewriting that they did for Center Script, that were basically work that Medavoy found for him. He was always play around an idea of cinema that was really, really interesting and really personal.
Mm. And then we have this huge gap, which as the older I get, the less huge it seems. You know, I mean, like when I was, I was discovering Malick, I think around about the same time you were, late 80s, early 90s, and then, you know, Thin Red Line came out, but I'd already discovered Badlands and Days of Heavens before that. And the idea of like, oh, he's gone missing, and it's you know, 10, 15, 20 years before he makes another film. Nowadays, I look at that 20-year gap and I think, well, you know, Jonathan Glazer, is, you know, it's 10, 15 years between films, and, you know, you hardly even notice. I mean, how much of that gap is sort of real in the sense that he's going away and just doesn't want to do it anymore? And how much of it is just like, no, there are just things that aren't projects that just aren't coming to fruition?
I think that there is a lot of mythology around this gap period, actually, because it's not easy to do cinema in this way. And in certain moment, you have a lot of projects that you are trying to make, and simply it was impossible to put together all the elements, and especially if you have an idea of really ambitious cinema, and sometimes it's also a question of working with the wrong producers and that's, in my opinion, it was happened, actually, in a way, Terry is also not the kind of director who is making whatever just to, you know, do something, and so he had many projects going ahead at the same time, and it's true that it's also I think that the experience with Desert Heaven, it was the first movie that he did with a major, was quite complicated, because to fit the approach with the industry of American cinema was very, very complicated, and so in a way it's always a question of find the right people also on the productive side. And I think, for example, the recently the bond with Grant Hill, who is the producer also of the Wachowski sister, of many, it's interesting how interesting are also the producer of Terry's movie, because I was quoting Mike Meadow, which is very, very interesting person who work for Apocalypse Now, but also the Rocky, and so it's really, and sometimes it's very difficult to put together that kind of movies, and so I think that the gap for many reasons, also for probably also for the will of exploring other things and also other countries, but it was always working on something.
Yeah. He's not sort of a hermit hiding away somewhere. He's always,
yeah, exactly. He's always this is not the case. Even if, of course, he was always hiding from the public scene, actually, and even when he was living in France. But this is something very related to the personality of Terry. We really like to have relationship with people that are very straightforward, without all the, you know, the sometimes the world of cinema is you think you are better than others just because you are working in cinema. This is something that happens all the time. Now that you are in a world, in an industry that is special in a way, you know, compared to other works, other things. It's something that Terry doesn't like at all, actually, because his enthusiasm is addressed to many things of the life in general. So and that's something that he wants to protect in a way.
So you've had a lot of conversations with him, and you've met him and everything. Did you find it hugely frustrating that you're having these wonderful conversations with him and you can't include any in the book? You can't quote him. You can't indirectly quote him. So, you know, how does that feel as a writer?
I never felt this frustration, just because it was so satisfying to have this exchange. Really, for me, it's a kind of father figure in a way. And so there is also the natural things to keep private, something that is so bonding and so important to you, actually. And I think that many people that work with him feel the same. It's something that you don't want to betray, something that is intimate in a way, you know? And so actually I think that on the other way, on the other hand, putting together all the people that the same feeling of the experience that they share working with him is a way of keeping alive this this way of creating this bond. So even if you are not talking directly about something that was personal with him, you can feel that there is some strength in the relationship, and which is something very peculiar. It happened to me with few people, but when it, for example, with Josteliani is the same, actually, and I had a similar experience, but also with other director that I work with. And you want to keep private something that you feel is like you know, a secret place in which things happen.
Yeah. Did you find there were some people who just refused to talk to you then, who you couldn't get on the record?
No, in my experience, no, actually, in the sense that, but again, what we did that we were moving very carefully, and just because we didn't want to be aggressive on the go, to we really wanted to establish a relationship with the people we were meeting, and so I think that people understood these things. Of course, sometimes they wanted to go back to him and understanding if he agree or whatever, but at the end, for one thing that we really spent a lot of time in doing was that all the people we were interviewing, we studied a lot all the things that they did, and really considering them as important as Malik. And but this is our attitude in general when we do a book or whatever, even when we write about theater. So we consider really that a production designer is important as the director, and so what we did is really to study all the movie that they did and understand their method, and this, I think, is something very rewarding, because at the end, when you start to have an exchange, you can talk of the craft, the way of working, which for me is always the most interesting things in cinema, but in art in general.
That's a fascinating way of looking at it. I think that's I noticed that when I was reading the book, that I'd flip back to the end notes, and the end notes would have these huge biographies of people who were well, as you say, you know, might have been written off as peripheral in a lesser book, but it gave you a really good sense of what you were saying right at the very beginning, of placing someone in the context of, you know, other people who are doing other things, and a world which is moving in and of itself.
Yeah, but because actually when you put the biography of someone, you discover also links that you didn't expect it. And this is the thrilling part, I think, in the sense that it's fantastic to understand that behind the movie there is the mind of someone that you didn't expect, you know. And for example, Dan Glass, who is the supervisor of the special effect of The Tree of Life, is the supervisor of many of the Wachowski movie, and you can see that there is this you can see there's something special in a level of the language of certain movies that reverberates, you know, and you understand the same things with Doug Trumbull, no? If you are behind 2001, Space Odyssey, and Encounter of the Third Kind, of Blade Runner, you understand that there is something that is going on from one movie to another, no? And I think that for a reader it's very interesting to have the tool to understanding this connection. It's something that I did, for example, when I did a book on Takeshi Kitano. At that point, he was working still, but at that point, very, very hard in television. So I thought that it was very interesting to put all the program that he did on television, and with all the details, a synopsis of the concept of the shows and the different things, because I understood how much important it was also for the cinema career, this aspect. And it's really like searching for gold in a way, you know, that you go deep inside the activity of someone and you always discover something new. And sometimes it's something that is coming also from another world, from the world of art. You discover, you know, that Terry filmed an art exhibition, and then you understand that it's really interesting to understand this path.
It's like the artist in the world, you know. You want to put them in the world where they're reading the newspaper in the morning at breakfast, and they're you know, they're watching television before they, you know, at night after they finished, you know, editing. So there's a, you know, all of these things. Who knows what sort of touches on them. So we go from the I would say triumphant return of the Thin Red Line, and I think it was widely seen as such. And then The New World and The Tree of Life. I just want to just move forward a little bit towards the sort of later films, because this is where I personally, as a viewer, begin to struggle, because I get to a point where I'm absolutely thinking each of these films in its own way is a masterpiece. The New World took me a little while to sort of actually come round to that idea. First viewing, I struggled a bit more with it. But it's probably the film that I go back to more often now and rewatch. But then with To the Wonder and Knight of Cups and Song of Songs, it's almost like there's this trilogy where he's really trying to push, I don't know. But again, this is just for me. He's trying to push narrative away. You know, it's like it's almost like a modernist in the turn of the 20th century, you know, like a Joyce character. You know, narrative isn't as important as experience. And why do you think he goes in that direction? What do you think is the leads him off there?
But I think that you know, is really a kind of in search of something. And I think that, for example, the way he used the voiceover in The Thin Red Line is really next step, you know, in so this way of collecting things and putting together and giving this emphasis. And in the movie, probably in the trilogy, really he wanted to experiment something new. In a way, I think that, for example, To the Wonder is really the consequence of The Tree of Life, in the sense that is really, in a way, the way Tree of Life was shot, that is quite unique, you know, because actually he had a lot of units all around the world working together, and it's really something that, for me, is very fascinating, the way. But he was also working in a different way in editing the movie, which is very important. He started working with several editors all together working at the movie, which is really something that now is very close to his way of giving birth to a movie, in the sense that you have a period of editing that is very long, in which, in a way, you have different approach to the same things. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way, as you say, to questioning the narratives and is really the fruit of this attitude, actually, to have a free way of letting things arise. And this is both in a way you are filming something and also in a way you are editing something. And I think that in this way he puts really a huge experimental way. In fact, most of that movie were shot back to back, and he was also able with the way they built also the production side of the movie. It was in a way that he finally found the freedom of experimenting, and for these things it was, for example, he abandoned in that three movies completely the script, which was something that it was in his mind from several years in a way, and so it was something that he was finally able to do, with some consequence also on the productive side, in the sense that you are, you know, trying to raise the movie without a script, which is something not that easy, actually. And so I think there was the time that all the elements were in place to start this experimenting, this valzer, in a way, this dance. Not really, because it's really a kind of dance, in the sense that when you see him shooting especially in the last movie, you understand that it is really a kind of choreography more than having actors acting, actually, because the way the camera is moving, the way that people enter inside, I think the incredible things that you can feel a great sense of authenticity, even if you don't like the movie or whatever, in the extras of a terrorist movie, which is something, you can feel that it's something really real there, and all of a sudden from the face of someone in the background, and this is something that I think he was looking for, he was aiming for.
Yeah, I think the film's very successful in the sense of sort of capturing moments, in the same way that, I mean, I've read Finnegan's Wake, God help me, and you know, there are sentences and phrases in Finnegan's Wake, even passages that will stop you in your tracks in their beauty. But as a novel, it's kind of unreadable. It breaks the whole idea of what a novel should be. And I find a similar sort of thing with these films, where I kind of enjoy bits, and that shot is wonderful, and that moment of music is wonderful, and that particular exchange is wonderful, but when they come together, I don't know. I mean, I've been rewatching them for obvious reasons, and gaining much more on rewatching them, but my first impression was very much I'm struggling.
No, I understand, and I understand. I think that, for example, I really, all the time, I really just abandoned to stay together with the movie, inside the movie, without thinking about the structure, without thinking too much. Even sometimes watching several movies as one movie, actually, in the sense that it's like. And in this way, I think that it was really honest that in that moment you wanted to experiment in the direction, and they did without compromise with other aspects.
I mean, these movies obviously go outside of your they're mostly happening after you finished your book, and then you have A Hidden Life, which very much feels like going back to narrative, going back to a period film, which is, again, these movies were all contemporary, whereas his previous films from Tree of Life back to Badlands were all period pieces. What was your reaction to A Hidden Life when you got to see it?
Hidden Life, it was really interesting, actually, because I was on set several times, which was a really, really fantastic experience, actually. And I think that Hidden Life is very interesting because it is exactly a mix of all the things that Terry experimented in his career, actually, because it's true that he went back in a way in the narrative of the Thin Red Line, or But at the same time, there is a lot of things that are there because of the experimented period that he had. And I think, for example, the way I think that Terry really, this way of experimenting with the cinema language, for example, what he did with the lenses, again, having this 8mm lens that give you this really this wide image, but also you have a distortion of the characters, and to incorporate this distortion or like something that is portray a feeling that is giving the sense of something is really like what happened in the painting with Schiele or other painters that were playing with the body of a character to give you the sense of a soul in a way, you know. And so if you see in Hidden Life, you have the moment of the strong bond, the strong love between the main characters, or the moment of, you know, something really cruel is going to happen, is together with this language in which, you know, the hands that go together with two lovers are completely distorted by the lens, these kind of things. I think that this is really linked to the experiment period that he had doing the From To The Wonder up to Song To Song. And so it's very interesting because it was combining, in that movie, it was combining these two elements. Shall I go back to have a narrative which is always elliptic and it was always very personal, and incorporating this ability that I think that he gained over the years to show feeling through really the power of an image, but really an image that it's really you search for that feeling. And I remember on set exactly the moment in which an actor feel also these things, in the sense that it feel that there is a strand between the character and the camera. There is something between these two elements. So you are giving your performance that is catched by something, and is not there that you just give a performance to no one. You are giving the performance to the camera. And this is something that is really for me, that's my vision, but it's really the fruit of this strong experimental period that he had, in which he started, for example, shooting with GoPro and other elements and things, playing with the actors in a different way. So I think that those things are together. For me, Hidden Life is fantastically put together, all this tension, so it's really another step,
another level almost.
Exactly.
Yeah. And were you also on the step? On the step on the set of his new film, which I think at the moment is called The Way of the Wind, but I might be.
Yeah. Yeah, I was there, and again it was I was editing at the time. I was editing my movie that it was executive produced by him, and which was another very nice experience, because actually I think that the story of Malik producing movie and be the executive producer is very interesting. It's interesting as much as the his career as a director. Because he's always helping and fostering people as, you know, other people did in the past with him, like Arthur Penn, for example. And I had these interesting things going on, that I was working on my movie, having him as executive producer, and assist some of the shooting. And again, it was completely free and very interesting again the way, and it's always that you incorporate something magic happening in the moment. Again, I share you just a memory with you there. Remember we were shooting in the ancient Appia, and all of a sudden a shepherd with a flock of sheep come into the ancient Appia, which is something amazing because you have the cars and everything, and all of a sudden is, you know, these hundreds of sheep and goats arrive, which is typical of Rome. And it was so powerful that and then they say, no, but we need to put that in a scene, actually. And so I went to the guy who was keeping the ships around there, and I discovered there was my neighbor that was living in my building, and I say, oh, can you please help us and shoot with the goats or some wine, and we did that. That's so amazing. Actually, is again as in the previous movie, it was really open to the magic. Actually, it was what was happening around, which is I think that is an incredible quality of Terry. But to have this quality, you need to have the right people around. And I think the crew that he built over the years is fantastic, because they are really ready to play with these unexpected and magic moments.
Absolutely. And okay, that's absolutely. And of course, your film is called The Book of Vision, is that correct?
Yeah.
And where can people see that?
Basically, it was released in the Venice Film Festival in 2020, mm-hmm. and then it was released in several countries all around the world. Now it needs to be released also in UK and in several countries already on the streaming platform. He had a theatrical release, which was a kind of a nightmare, because it was exactly in the COVID period. So we were waiting for theater to reopen and understanding when it was possible. But now in several countries is on Apple TV or on Amazon and several streaming platforms.
Brilliant. So we'll steer some listeners towards that film. That'd be great. And can we also, Carlo, could I ask you for a recommended book, that a film book that you would recommend people read, either that's has influenced you personally or it's just a book you've enjoyed?
Not related to dairy in general.
Yeah.
You mean... Yeah.
No, it doesn't have to be specific.
Okay.
Because your book is the book that everybody should read about Terry, right?
No, actually, for me, Deleuze with the two book, the I don't know the translation in English, Immagine Tempo, Immagine Movimento is in Italian, and is I don't know how they translated in English, but they are the two books on cinema of Deleuze, which for me are really they really, I don't know, they opened my mind in a way. I was looking from someone telling me that the movie is not just in the screening, but it's around us, actually. That no, it's something that is bigger than the actual screening. And I found, so I really like the approach of philosopher to cinema. And so for sure, those books are very, I think they're fantastic. And I'm very a big fan of Michel Chion, which is the again, is Fincredi, but he's also a philosopher, and that he focus a lot for the sound in cinema. And for example, his book on Kubrick, I think that it's really fantastic, actually, because it really gives you a different approach to the cinema of Kubrick, but also to cinema in general. And there is a book about the sound in cinema. He did also a fantastic book on the sound in The Thin Red Line, and which is fantastic. And so basically, I really like when somebody, cinema writers, is putting also cinema in perspective, in a crossover with philosophy and sometimes sociology, and these are the things that I like the most.
I love that idea of film being analogous to how we're living our lives in the world as well. You know, the more I read about how we perceive things, just how our brain edits things, how it synchronizes sound and vision, because obviously the sound arrives in our brains much quicker than the image does.
Yeah.
So the brain slows it down and synchronizes it so that we can, it agrees. And when you're walking down the street, you don't see like a handheld camera version. You see a Steadicam version of reality. So
no, but this is very interesting, because I think in this way, you know, what I think that over the years, I have to say that I'm really nostalgic of the period in which film critics and writers on cinema were experimenting a bit, and when you know, offered to the reader thoughts and not just, because I think that nowadays what I call a furor recensendi, this necessity of writing of a movie immediately after the screening. Yeah, exactly. You know that you have just you need to put a tag on everything and whatever. It's something that for me is killing art in general, and specific things of cinema and art, which is the mystery. Actually, if you cut the mystery for something, I think that you are really killing the heart. Again, I go back to Sam Shepard that was saying you can analyze the poetry of Sylvia Plath, writing a lot of words, but there is something, there is a mystery, something that hits you, that is there and you can explain, actually. I think that cinema has this power, no, of hits you without the necessity of explaining something. And I would like to go back to this ability to cope with the mystery without being afraid, because I think that the audience now is very afraid not to catch something. Instead, if you don't catch something, it's fine. you can relax. Imagine the first people that watch 2001. And no, it's fine. You can relax. You can stay in that theater. And just as you are in the street, have the things moving around you in a way, you know? And this is the magic of cinema. And I really would like to go back to these things, because I think that it is the way to understand many of contemporary movies that is much ahead of the film critic, sometimes of the audience. And so in a way you feel that is a very prolific moment, very interesting, in which you can mix genre, you can really have many things, because many things already are in the history of cinema. But sometimes we have this anxiety of putting a tag on something, no, of describing something, of selling something somehow.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like we're confronted by this wilderness, and all we want to do is make little sort of topiary animals out of it. It's like, no, wait a second, just appreciate the thing as it is first, you know. That's wonderful. I couldn't have said it better myself. Absolutely wonderful thought. I really, it makes me remember when I was a kid, there was a whole time when I didn't think there could be such a thing as a bad film, because I was just like, I just assumed that if it was on the cinema, adults had made it, it was good. You know, it had to be good. Who would do anything bad? It had to be good.
Yeah.
And there's a bit when you're like 13, 14, where you suddenly go, oh, wait a minute, is this bad? Is this a bad film? But, you know, going just for one second back to Terrence Malick, the fact that those films that I don't quite get in some ways are sort of like almost the most precious films, because those are the ones that you go back to and sort of worry about and think about. And I love Sergio Leone, but I go back to Once Upon a Time in America because I can't quite get it. I love Stanley Kubrick, but I go back to The Shining all the time because I just can't quite. It's not good. It's not masterpiece for me, but it is.
Yeah, but this. I think that it happened often actually in the career of a filmmaker. There is something that you go back to this movie that are kind of turning point in a way, and they have many elements that escape from again from the categorization, something that is really easy to understand. For this reason, they are vital in a way, you know. And so it's
That's amazing. Listen, Carlo, thanks so much for your time. Thanks so much for your book, Rehearsing the Unexpected, which I have been underlining and will be plagiarizing unashamedly in the year to come. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So that was Carlo and I talking about Terrence Malick. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I found it fascinating for motives that have been made apparent since last week when I told you that I'm also working on a biography of Terrence Malick. But we decided, Carlo and I, that it would be better for us to concentrate on his book this episode. Sometime down the line, we could have another episode and talk about perhaps my book. Who knows? Let's see how that goes. Thanks very much to Elliot Atkins for the music. Thanks to Ali Harwood for the artwork. And thanks to you, the listener, without which this would all be a rather futile project. But with you, it's absolutely fantastic. I'm having the time of my life. So thank you very, very, very much for all the encouragement I get over the weeks and over the last year that I've been doing this. Until next week, take care.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.